Welcome to Torah Temecha Parsha with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Chana Meira, and today we'll be studying Parshat Vayechi. The Parsha is 3.5 prakim, starting in the middle of 47, Mem Zayin, and finishing at the end of 50, Nun. It has 85 psukim. So let's start. We're going to go through each of the seven aliyahs, and at the end of each aliyah, discuss a small idea. In the first aliyah, Yaakov has lived in Egypt for 17 years. And the Torah tells us he's 147 years, and his days come close to dying. Yaakov calls Yosef and asks him to swear by putting his hand under his thigh that he would do chesed and emes, and he would not bury him in Egypt, but rather bury him with his ancestors, and Yosef agrees. Once Yosef swears, Yaakov bows to the head of his bed where the Shechina is. In the next parak, Yosef learns that his father is ill, and he brings his sons to go visit Yaakov. Just to clarify, there are two visits. One, Yaakov is summoning Yosef, and the second one, Yosef is coming of his own free will, but this time with his two sons. Yaakov explains to Yosef that Hashem appeared to him in Luz and promised him that he would make Yaakov into a great nation, and he would give him the land of Israel as an inheritance. In order to fulfill this promise, he mentions that the two sons born to him in Egypt, Ephraim and Manasseh, will be to him like Reuven and Shimon, and will also receive a portion in the land, in fulfillment of what Hashem had promised him in Luz. Yaakov continues by saying that when he returned from Padan, he buried Rachel by the side of the road. The pasuk then says, Yisrael, not Yaakov, sees Yosef's sons and asks, who are these? And Yosef replied, these are my sons, who Hashem has given me here. And Yaakov asks Yosef to bring them closer so he can bless them. So a lot of interesting phraseology used in this section. First of all, you should know that Parshat Vayechi, the way it's written in the Torah, you wouldn't know that a new parasha has started. It just continues as if it's another pasuk. Usually it's a new column or a new paragraph or there's a decent space. Here it just carries on as if it's another word in the sentence. And Rashi gives an explanation for this. Lama parasha ze stuma? Lefisha kevan sheniftar Yaakov avinu, nistamu einehem velibam shel Yisrael mitzrat. Hashibud. It's like a play on words. It's a closed parsha because once Yaakov dies, the hearts and eyes of Israel will become closed because of the suffering of the exile. And this is an important Rashi because it frames the tension in Parashat Vayechi. There's a push and pull between Galut and Geula. There are many hints to the impending Galut, but there are also many promises of the Geula that even as they're about to enter the Galut Mitzrayim, they should know that they're definitely going to be redeemed, and both of these are heavily hinted to in this parasha. After such a long and difficult life, you'd expect to hear about the wonderful time that Yaakov finally gets to have with Yosef, enjoying his children and grandchildren, but it's not mentioned at all. The reason is because the true growth and character development comes from struggles, not from a peaceful living. So Yaakov developed into his most perfect self and became Yisrael through all his trials and tribulations. Now that he has time of peace, the Torah just dismisses it. And you see this with all the Avos. There's very little about Yitzchak's life, and there's very little about Avram after that Gedah, because once they finish their struggle, there's not much for us to learn from them. You'll notice that when Yaakov asks Yosef to swear, he tells him to place his hand under his thigh, just like Avraham had asked Eliezer to place his hand under his thigh. Because both of these oaths were crucial for the future success of the Jewish people, Avram was asking Eliezer to swear that he would find a wife for Yitzchak, not from the children of Canaan who were cursed, but only from the line of Avraham. Similarly, Yaakov is insistent that as Yisrael, the founder of the Jewish people, not as Yaakov, the individual father, he had to be buried in the land of Israel. Why was he so insistent that he be buried in the land of Israel? So Rav Hirsch gives a beautiful explanation. He says they'd been living now in Egypt for 17 years and he'd watched his family become acclimated to the Egyptian ways. In Rav Hirsch's way, he says they'd turned their Nile into the Jordan. And he perceived that they didn't see Egypt as exile anymore. And he wanted them to realize that this is not their homeland. The land of Israel is their homeland. So if he is brought back to Israel and they know that their forefathers are buried there, then they'll realize Egypt is not the place for them and one day they will have to go home. The reason that Yaakov asks for chesed and emet is anytime we do kindness for a dead person, like for burial, it's called emes, because you can never be paid back. In the second conversation that Yaakov has with Yosef, when he brings his sons and he wants to give them the bracha, this is when he explains to him why he couldn't bury Rachel in Ma'arat HaMechpelah. Rashi gives us a beautiful insight into why Yaakov buried Rachel by the roadside. He says, Va'akbarash sham, and I buried her. V'lo halachti afilu lebeit lechem, and I didn't bring her even to Beit Lechem. Lehechnisa la'aretz, to bring her to the land, to bury her. V'yadati sheyesh bilibcha elah, and I know you're carrying in your heart resentment because of this. Aval dalacha, but you should know, she'al pi hadibur kivriteha sham. It was because of Hashem's command that I buried her there. Why? She'tehe le'ezra levaneha, that she should be a help to her children. Keshiyegalam Nevuzaradan, because one day in the future Nevuzaradan is going to exile them. V'hayu avadim derech sham, and they're going to be slaves, and they're going to be transported past that way. Yatzta Rachel will come out al kivra, from her kevra, uvacha, and she will cry, umavakeshet aleim rachamim, and she will beg for their mercy. Shenehemar, as it says in Yirmiyahu, kol brama nishma, a voice is heard from on high. So Rashi paints this very poignant picture of Rachel standing at the wayside, begging and pleading for her children as they go out into exile. And it is for this reason that she can't be buried in Ma'arat HaMachpelah. So again, you have this push and pull of Galut and Geula, already referencing a further Galut. In the second Aliyah, the eyes of Yisrael are growing weak and he can't see so well. So when Yosef presents his sons to Yaakov, he wants to connect with them in a more tactile way to compensate for the fact that he can't see them. And he hugs them and he kisses them and he exclaims, I never thought I would see you, Yosef. And now Hashem is even showing me your children. Yosef takes his own sons off Yaakov's knees and he arranges them in the proper order for the blessings. Manasseh the oldest by Yaakov's right and Ephraim the younger by Yaakov's left. But Yaakov, even though he can't see with his eyes, he has Ruach HaKodesh, and he switches his hands, and he puts his right hand on Ephraim and the left on Manasseh. And he gives them a bracha that we say that's become part of our Maariv, part of our Shema. Hamalach HaGol Otzi Mikorah Yivarech Et HaNarim Ve'Yikre Behem Shemi V'Shem Avasa Avram V'Yitzchak V'Yidku L'Rov Bekerev Ha'aretz. Famous bracha. In the third Aliyah, Yosef sees what Yaakov's done and he's upset. He tries to rearrange his father's hands and Yaakov says to him, Yadati bani, yadati, I know what I'm doing. Gam hu yiyeh la'am. Manasseh will also become a nation. V'gam hu yigdal, he'll be great in his own way. V'olam echa v'katan, but the younger son, yigdal mimenu, he'll be greater than him. V'zaro yiyeh malagon. So you can understand that Yosef starts freaking out. The whole reason he was imprisoned and his whole suffering started because his father showed him favoritism and now his father's doing the same thing with his children. But Yaakov says to him, you know what? It's a fact of life that some kids are more gifted than others, have more of a role to play than others. You can't treat everyone the same all the time. What you should do is give your children enough love that they will at least have shalom between them to be able to accept the fact that they have different roles in life. And he says, Yevarech Yisrael Emor, so Yisrael, talking about himself, blesses them. Yisimcha Elokim Kefraim v'Menashe. All future sons in the Jewish people on Friday night receive this bracha that you should be like Ephraim and Menashe. Why like Ephraim and Menashe? Throughout Sefer Bereshit, we had this selection and rejection between the sons, and it was always the younger son who overshadowed the older son. Part of this is because the Torah doesn't like inherited status. You've got to work for your status, so just because you're born first doesn't mean you're automatically the greatest. But throughout Bereshit, we see this tension that every time the older is supplanted by the younger, he either murders his brother, fights with his brother, hates his brother. This is the first time in the entire Sefer that the older brother is able to accept that the younger brother has a different role for him, which is a testament to the excellent chinuch of Yosef. But we want our children to know that all of them have value. Some may play a more prominent role, but this doesn't diminish our regard for them, and it doesn't diminish our love for them. They're all our children, and they're all beloved. And Ephraim and Manasseh are the first brothers who can hear and accept this message. Yaakov then finishes off with a private promise to Yosef that he will be returned to Eretz Israel, and he gifts him an extra portion in the city of Shechem. In the fourth Aliyah, Yaakov gathers his sons around him, and he intended to reveal the end of days, but Hashem prevented him from doing so. So instead, he started with his brachot, and the brachot are a mixture of criticism, pointing out characteristics, and promising of good things. Yaakov's words to Reuven speak of his unrealized potential. Reuven should have been the firstborn, but because he let his anger cloud his judgment, he lost out. Then Yaakov talks about the violence of Shimon and Levi, and he curses their anger. Very important when we criticize children, we don't criticize them, we criticize the behavior. Now Yehud is nervous because he's seen Reuven, Shimon, Levi all get criticized, and he knows that, you know, he sinned with Tamar, he's starting to step backwards. But no, Yaakov calls him forward and he says, Gur Aryeh Yehuda. He acknowledges him and he blesses him to be the leader of the brothers. The Bala term says the first words of Gur Aryeh Yehuda is the gematria 14, which is the numerical value of David. And it says, Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda u'machokek mi ben raglav. Once David becomes a king, the line of kings will never leave Yehuda until the coming of Mashiach. Zevulun is given the bracha of wealth because he will support his brother Yisachar, who will carry the burden of Torah. And together these two tribes will form a partnership. And it finishes off the Aliyah, Dan will be a judge and defend the honor of the people. In the fifth Aliyah, Gad will be blessed either with military strength or good fortune. Asher is blessed with oil and wealth. Yosef's bracha is very extensive, which shows Yaakov's special love for him. And included in it is the same bracha that Avram gave to Yitzchak and Yitzchak gave to Yaakov. Yaakov passes it on to Yosef. In the sixth Aliyah, Yaakov finishes all the brachas with Binyamin will be a wolf who will tear his prey in the morning, and he will continue eating till the evening. He'll divide his spoils. The morning refers to Shaul, who starts the kingship. He's the first king. And the evening is Mordechai and Esther, when they will redeem the Jews at the end of Galut Babel. Yaakov finishes his bracha, and the pasuk says, Kol ele shiftei Yisrael shnei masar. All of these are the tribes of Israel 12. You might think, because there were some criticisms, that some of the sons were not worthy, so the Torah testifies they're all branches from the same strong root. They all come from Yaakov, they're all good, they're all holy, and this ending suggests that beyond the recorded prophecies that we have, Yaakov gave each son a personalized bracha, tailored to their specific needs, and his parting words serve to empower every individual how they can improve themselves to be a worthy bearer of their mission. Once again, Yaakov stresses to all 12 brothers he must be buried in Ma'arat HaMachpelah. It's interesting that when he asks Yosef to bury him, it's phrased in the negative, don't bury me in Egypt. When he talks to the brothers, it's the positive, bury me in Ma'arat HaMachpelah, in the place that was bought from Ephron Achiti. And he stresses it because this was the first piece of land that was bought by Avram Avinu, and it's our first connection with the land of Israel. Again, it's re-referencing the Geula. You're about to start Galut, but don't lose your connection to where we really come from. Then says that Yaakov gathered his feet, and it says, Vaigva v'yosef alamav, but it doesn't say that he died. And Rashi says on this, Umet lo nemrabo v'amru ramateinu arabas teach us, Yaakov avinu lo met. Yaakov never died. What do you mean he never died? He's embalmed, he's buried, he has a whole mourning ceremony. The thing is, we all live on through our children. And if Yaakov's 12 children were Shalem, then he continues to live on through them as they carry on doing Hashem's will. And we, thousands of years later, B'nai Yisrael, the descendants of Yisrael, are still following in Hashem's way. Yaakov lives on through us as well. After this, Yosef ordered his father to be embalmed, which was a whole 40-day process. And then all of Egypt mourned for Yaakov a further 30 days. And then Yosef sends a message to Paro to ask permission to bury his father. And the Mefarshim all discuss why didn't he just go directly. So one explanation is because he was in mourning, he couldn't go in front of Paro wearing his sackcloth. But also we see strains of the exile starting to happen. Yosef is not as free with his power as he used to be before. Also, he didn't want to be accused of dual loyalty, the old Galut dual loyalty gremlin. However, because he swore to fulfill his father's word, Paro respected that, and he allowed him to go up to bury his father. And it says that Yaakov had a tremendous burial. It explains all of Egypt accompanied them, and when they came to Eretz Canaan and the Canaanites saw this huge entourage, they all came out. Everybody came to mourn him. Afterwards, when everyone comes back to Egypt, the brothers are worried. What is Yosef going to do now that their father has died and can't be there to protect them? So they sent a message to Yosef with a bit of lying for Shalom, and they said, your father gave us a message to give you after his death, saying, please forgive the crime of your brothers, for they've dealt badly with you. And Yosef wept because he knew that this wasn't true. Yaakov would have told him directly, and there's a machloket whether Yaakov ever did know that they sold the brothers. There's hints he may have, but we're not sure. And in this scene, we see the final tshuva of the brothers and of Yosef. The brothers all willingly bow down to Yosef and say, "We are your servant." They willingly enact the prophecy of the dream that Yosef had had all those years before. But Yosef answers with tremendous humility and he says, "Al tiro, don't be afraid. Ki atachat Elokim anochim, I'm place of God." And Rabbi Michael Hatton has a beautiful explanation. He says, this concluding scene highlights the profound relationship between human free will and divine guidance, which you see particularly through the story of Yosef and his brothers, but we've seen it throughout Sefer Bereshis. Individuals will make their own choices with their own free will, but Hashem involves just enough to make sure that their paths are ultimately guided to where they are supposed to go. So the journey of Yosef and his brothers serve as a reminder that things that seem random, and sometimes even things that we think are our own free will, are actually part of a divine plan. And in the end, Yosef can articulate this and acknowledge that at the time what felt malicious was actually Hashem's plan for a greater purpose, to preserve his family. In the last aliyah, Yosef promises to support his brothers and families. Yosef lives to be 110. He gets to see his children, his grandchildren, even his great-grandchildren. On his deathbed, he promises his brothers that Hashem will eventually take them out of Egypt, and he gives them the code, Pakod Yifkad, and he asks them to remember him and take his remains with them when they leave. Yosef dies, as does the brothers, and thus ends Sefer Bereshis. Now, you would think that Bereshis would end with the death of Yaakov. Why does the parasha carry on with this last detail about Yosef's death? So Rabbanit Rimon explains that throughout the Sefer, this family of individuals has evolved into a nation. And in order to fully become who they're meant to be, it's going to involve the painful process of exile. So Yosef stands with his brothers throughout this process, not just to give them physical food, but also to give them spiritual support through their exile. And that's why he's not buried. He's placed in a coffin and he stays with them throughout their time in Egypt and throughout their 40 years in the desert. And he crosses the Jordan with them and he's only buried once they're all settled the land of Israel, they've conquered the land of Israel. That's when he is finally buried. Why is he the brother who accompanies them? Even though we know all the 12 Shvatim were brought up with Moshe when they came out of Egypt, but why is Yosef emphasized? Because Yosef has two qualities in his character, and both are invaluable to keep a nation alive during exile. In Parashat Vayeshev, we see Yosef has exceptional talent, and any difficult situation that he has, he is able to use it to strengthen himself and come out even stronger. He's sold as a slave, he rises up to high position in Potiphar's house, he's thrown into prison, he becomes the head of the prison, he leaves prison, he becomes the king's second in command. His ability to manage challenges and overcome them is crucial, because the nation of Israel will one day need the same talent to survive during exile. But a more important trait is that Yosef, wherever he is very cognizant of his personal exile. He maintains his identity even in a foreign environment. He lives in Egypt for many years, but he never loses awareness of who he is. He's always called an Ivri, a Jew. Potiphar's wife calls him that, the head butler calls him that, Paro calls him that. Right? So as Israel faces exile in Egypt, they look to Yosef as a model for navigating hardship, that they're going to use the galus to come out stronger. And the way they're going to do this is to never forget their identity of who they are. We began the Sefer by discussing how Hashem created the world with the letter Bet to instill in us bracha. To access the bracha, we have to follow Hashem's will. But when we go against Hashem's will, we bring klala, curse into the world. The entire Sefer Bereshit is the process of humans finding a way to access this bracha and balancing the power of being Tzelem Elokim without trying to appropriate the power of Elokim, as the Nachash originally tempted Chava and said, "If you eat from this tree, v'yitem ke'elokim yodeh tov v'ra, you'll be like God, knowing good and bad." Now in Vayechi, after the many trials and tribulations, the family of Yaakov is ready to be the ones who make that covenant with Hashem, to access the bracha, to tap into their Tzelem Elokim, while understanding their role in the world. As Yosef says to his brothers, "Ki atachat Elokim anochi," he knows he's not in place of God. The Sefer starts with a base for bracha, and it ends with the brachas of Yaakov. The family is chosen, and they're ready to transform into a nation during the next Sefer, Shemot. Chazak, chazak, v'nis chazak.